When a Florida toddler disappears from his bed and into the summer night, the investigation that follows is as controversial as it is urgent. An open window, a media firestorm, and a series of tragedies complicate the search for a missing child in this episode of Last Seen Alive. Thanks for listening to Last Seen Alive. I'm your host, Leah, crime analyst by day and true crime storyteller by night.
I'm your co-host, Scott.
Apologies if I sound a little different than usual today. I'm trying to get over a case of COVID and my voice is a little rough, but I've been mainlining as much herbal tea with honey as humanly possible in preparation for this recording session, so I think this is as good as it's going to get for a while, and I didn't want to delay or skip this episode. Speaking of being sick, while scrolling from bed one day, I stumbled across a news article that, frankly, I hoped was part of some bizarre fever dream. I decided to tuck it away and reread it again later, and sadly, I've now done so and have to admit to myself, and all of you, that the news was in no way a product of my imagination. So here goes with the most soul-crushing past case update ever. Remember a few months ago when we did an update on the Brittany Williams case and covered how a woman had come forward with DNA test results claiming to be that missing little girl?
I do.
So I was overjoyed to hear that, and I know you were too, Scott. I was so excited that against all odds, it seemed that Brittany was still alive.
It remains one of my happiest moments in podcasting.
It was one of your happiest moments in podcasting because the FBI and Henrico police worked together to perform their own DNA analysis at an FBI lab and also a comprehensive investigation into the claim. And just a couple days ago, they finally announced their findings, which were that the adopted woman who thought she was Brittany actually isn't.
That's soul-crushing.
Yeah. Now, investigators didn't include very much information in this announcement, only that they did a test, an investigation, and were able to determine that it wasn't her. So I can only assume, based off of the LabCorp DNA test results that were presented in that news special, unless those are somehow wrong, that this woman is in fact a relative, most likely a half-sister, of Brittany's only known half-sister. Investigators haven't released any information on the nature of this possible relationship, but it occurs to me that she might have been a previously unknown half-sibling or other relative, which I suppose would explain the remarkable physical resemblance.
I still can't figure out how she has the same scars, though.
Right? That's been driving me crazy, too. But the bottom line is, despite a preponderance of similarities and coincidences, she's not Brittany. And as much as I'd like to believe that she is and embrace some sort of conspiracy cover-up theory, I have to admit, after reviewing what information I could find, an in-depth FBI investigation beats a news special and my own wishful thinking.
It does.
Unfortunately, it's back to the drawing board with little Brittany's case. If you're not familiar with it, I encourage you to go back and listen to our episode on the unsolved disappearance of Brittany Williams. Unfortunately, she's almost certainly deceased, and justice has yet to be carried out on her behalf. And now, on to today's story about another missing child. Trenton Duckett was last seen alive on August 27, 2006. He was only 2 years old when he disappeared from his bed and his bedroom window was found to be open, the screen cut. The scene was eerily reminiscent of another crime from nearly a century before, one of the most famous crimes in American history. I'm speaking, of course, about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, which has retained a permanent place in the American public's imagination since 1932. And although Trenton's life was much different from the wealthy Lindbergh babies, both of their disappearances began the same way, with an open window and the discovery that more than just night air had crept into the room. Although the Lindbergh case culminated tragically in the discovery of the missing child's body, Trenton Duckett remains missing, his case unsolved. And to really understand his disappearance, we need to start before he was born. Trenton's parents, Melinda and Joshua, met and began dating when they were both students at a high school in Lockport, Florida. During Melinda's senior year, she became pregnant by Joshua and gave birth to their son, Trenton, shortly after graduating high school. Life for the Young family was tumultuous. Melinda and Joshua got married when Trenton was 11 months old, but their relationship was intensely strained. An article by Mabel Perez for the Ocala Star-Banner describes their marriage as, quote, a saga filled with accusations and lies, end quote. And I've got to say, that's accurate. Melinda frequently clashed heads with Joshua, and perhaps even more so, with Joshua's mother, Carla. Reportedly, Carla actively and frequently inserted herself into the young couple's efforts to raise their son, and this really bothered Melinda, who didn't get along with her mother-in-law. Police involvement in the young family's issues wasn't uncommon. For example, in April of 2005, Joshua called the police and told them that Melinda was, quote, squeezing, shaking, and threatening to harm their son, end quote.
And threatening? That already seems pretty highly aggressive.
Yeah, squeezing and shaking an infant can be very dangerous, even deadly, so I guess threatening to further harm their son would have been a better way for him to put it. However, when police and social services investigated, they found Trenton healthy and in good condition and weren't able to find any evidence to support the claims of child abuse. And it's important to note that by this time, Melinda and Joshua were no longer a couple. Although they were still legally married, they'd separated from each other. A month later, as they each battled for custody of Trenton, Melinda and Joshua were both court-ordered to attend parenting classes. During this time period, Trenton was actually placed into relatives and even foster care several times. Joshua was at one point granted custody of Trenton, but after just a few weeks, he wrote a letter to the court stating that the things he'd previously accused Melinda of weren't true. He'd completely fabricated the claims of child abuse and threats. In the affidavit submitted to the court, which we posted a photocopy of on our website, you can find the link in the episode's description, Joshua states that he made these false claims about Melinda due to, quote, pressure and influence, end quote, from his mother, Carla. He also specifically stated that he didn't believe Melinda had ever done or would ever do anything to harm their son, Trenton.
Well, that's a good revelation in a shockingly depressing episode so far.
Yes. Unfortunately, this is not a happy episode, but you know, what episode that we cover is. It's always especially hard when it's about a child, though. One relevant thing to note here is not only was Carla Joshua's mom, but at the time this was happening, she was also his main source of financial support. So, despite being a young adult, he was still pretty dependent on her, which may explain some of this. Meanwhile, Melinda completed the court-ordered parenting classes, while Joshua abandoned them, according to an article by Travis Reed for the Washington Post. A social worker also made several home visits to Melinda's residence with positive results. So, after all this and receiving the affidavit from Joshua, the courts awarded sole custody of Trenton to Melinda. And about 6 weeks later, Melinda officially filed for divorce from Joshua. When she filed for divorce, she cited a MySpace message that she claimed Joshua had sent her. In this message, which was both obscene and rife with threats of violence, Joshua allegedly accused Melinda of taking his son from him, referred to her with racial slurs, and threatened to hunt down and kill both Melinda and Trenton.
Well, I just have to point out, is it really even taking the son from him if he's not willing to go and finish the parenting classes that the court ordered?
Great question. No, it's not. And because of this message, the court issued a protective order that forbade Joshua from having contact with Melinda or Trenton, understandably. However, investigators would later discover, after Trenton's disappearance, that Joshua hadn't actually sent that message. Rather, Melinda had had access to his MySpace login information and had actually sent the message to herself from his account. Investigators say they were able to definitively determine that the message had been sent from Melinda's computer.
Like, what's even going on with these people right now? It's all underhanded schemes so far is what it seems.
It is. So as we can see, although the lies and false accusations may have started with Joshua, they came from both sides in this relationship, unfortunately. Now, we know why Joshua lied about Melinda. He stated in that affidavit that his mother pressured and influenced him to do so. As for why Melinda made such serious false accusations about Joshua, it's difficult to say. She already had custody of Trenton. Perhaps she wanted revenge against Joshua for falsely accusing her. Which, you know, I get it. I don't approve of it, but I get it.
I was thinking that it's possible she sent it as a way to trigger the divorce proceedings.
Well, you can just file for divorce. You don't have to have an evil MySpace message to go with it. People get divorced every day.
Well, I wasn't sure if they had laws like some states do where you have to be separated for so long before you can actually divorce.
You know, that's a good question. I don't actually know about Florida divorce laws now or in 2006. But regardless of her motivation, Joshua and Melinda's relationship was clearly an unhealthy one, to put it mildly. So this was the state of the young parents' relationship whenever their two-year-old son disappeared. They were in the midst of a bitter divorce and Melinda had sole custody of Trenton. It's safe to say that there were likely bitter feelings on each side. Joshua and Melinda had been living separately for some time at this point. Melinda had an apartment where she lived with Trenton. She worked hard to provide for herself and her young son, and Trenton attended daycare during the day while she was at either of the two jobs she worked. Meanwhile, she was also working on earning a degree from a local community college, which she hoped would allow her to secure a better job in the future. In an interview for the Ocala Star-Banner, the owner of that daycare has stated that Melinda seemed like a very good parent. For example, if the daycare called Melinda to let her know that Trenton only had a couple diapers left, rather than waiting until the next day to bring in more diapers, Melinda would leave work immediately to bring in more. So, with Melinda holding full custody, Trenton's schedule had settled down to a predictable one where he received professional child care whenever Melinda was at work and unable to be with him. On August 27th, the day of Trenton's disappearance, Melinda put him to bed at approximately 6:30 in the evening. He had his own bedroom in their apartment and slept in a toddler bed. No one lived in the apartment besides Trenton and Melinda, but that evening she did have two friends over. They arrived at 7 o'clock and watched a comedy movie with Melinda. After the movie's end at approximately 9 o'clock, Melinda peeked into Trenton's room to check on him, and that was when she realized something was terribly wrong. Trenton's bed was empty, and he hadn't just climbed out of bed to play. He was nowhere in the room and nowhere in the apartment. Panicked, Melinda rushed outside and began searching the grounds of the apartment complex. Meanwhile, one of her two visiting friends dialed 911 and reported Trenton's absence to the dispatcher. After he spoke to dispatch for a little while, Melinda re-entered the apartment, took the phone, and took over the conversation with dispatch, describing Trenton and what he was wearing. We've linked to a transcript of the 911 call on our website, so you can read the entire thing if you'd like. One line that stands out, though, is when Melinda tells the dispatcher, "I know who friggin' did it." Now, she never told the dispatcher who she believed was responsible for Trenton's disappearance, but she showed the threatening MySpace message to officers when they arrived. Remember, at this point, police didn't know the message had been faked, so we can infer that she most likely was blaming Joshua.
It sounds like a logical and reasonable conclusion at this point.
I think so. When police arrived at the apartment, they found a possible answer as to how Trenton had disappeared without any of the adults in the apartment seeing him.
Was the window unlocked?
Well, it was more than unlocked. Yes, when police inspected Trenton's empty bedroom, they discovered that the window screen above his bed had been cut. The cut was 10 inches in length. Now, that's not a very generous opening if we're imagining an adult climbing through it. However, this window was located above Trenton's bed, so potentially, someone could have stood outside the window, reached through the cut, picked Trenton up, and pulled him through it, which is what Melinda reportedly came to believe had happened. Alternatively, I suppose it's possible that someone could have cut the screen, then reached through to pop it out, entered the bedroom through the window, and then popped the screen back into place after exiting through the window with Trenton.
That seems like a lot of work to replace it after you've already cut it. Like, at that point, just go for it, in my opinion.
Yeah, it does seem a little pointless. Naturally, investigators attempted to determine whether the cut in the screen had been made from outside or inside of the window. But unfortunately, analysis was inconclusive. They also collected all the sharp, bladed instruments they could find in Melinda's apartment, which included a few knives and a box cutter. There was no evidence to suggest that they'd been used to cut the screen, but they also couldn't be ruled out. As you've probably gleaned already, investigators were considering the possibility that Melinda might have had something to do with her own son's disappearance. And of course, statistically speaking, when children are harmed or disappear, a parent or guardian is the most likely suspect. Although it does happen, it's far more rare for a child to be abducted by a stranger. As the investigation unfolded, Melinda was painted in very different lights depending on who investigators spoke to. Melinda's grandparents, who lived nearby and were like a second set of parents to her, described her as an attentive and loving mother who would never harm her child. And then we have similar opinions from people like the daycare owner who we mentioned earlier. However, her estranged husband and his family, and by his family I mean his mom, described her differently, portraying her as a difficult, an emotionally volatile, even hateful person with psychological issues.
Well, I think it's safe to take his mother's opinion of her with a grain of salt at this point if she did pressure him into falsely accusing her.
Yeah, both of them. I mean, because of that incident, I'm just going to create mentally the big old Carla and Joshua mental salt bucket. And every time they say something, I'm going to throw a handful in.
Yeah.
Now, Melinda had actually been diagnosed with depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, and perfectionist personality features. Melinda was aware of her conditions and had openly admitted that they caused her to struggle with intrusive thoughts and setting extremely high standards for herself and others. She also had a history of self-harm, specifically cutting her arm on at least one occasion as a teenager. And sure, living with depression or obsessive compulsive disorder, or any other psychological disorder, can be stressful and challenging for the individual and potentially others around them. But having obsessive compulsive disorder or any other psychological condition certainly doesn't make someone violent. I've said before in past episodes and will say it again. Statistically speaking, individuals who suffer from mental illnesses are far more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. With that being said, some people with obsessive compulsive disorder may experience intrusive thoughts of harming others. But I haven't been able to locate any sources indicating Melinda experienced the condition in such a way. And even if she did experience such thoughts, that doesn't mean she would act on them. On the subject of her diagnoses, though, how she came to be diagnosed in the first place is perhaps a telling story in and of itself.
What makes you say that?
Well, Melinda had been briefly admitted into a psychiatric facility after Joshua had engineered a misunderstanding that had landed her there. And by that I mean that he was speaking on the phone to Melinda while in the presence of a local police chief, reportedly trying to bait Melinda into saying something that would allow the chief to take custody of her under Florida's Baker Act, a law that allows law enforcement to detain people for the purpose of securing emergency mental health services for them.
If he's openly trying to bait them in front of a police chief, that's a significant abuse of that law.
Absolutely. During and this go on.
It also draws into question the integrity of that police chief.
Moving on. During this conversation, Melinda threatened to end her and Joshua's relationship. Joshua put the phone on speaker for part of the conversation, during which Melinda threatened to end it all. In context, this was, again, a threat to end their relationship. Out of context, the police chief interpreted it as a threat to commit suicide, and Melinda was therefore made to go to a hospital. There, she was evaluated and soon released without any recommendations for treatment or medication for any psychological disorder. But also, while there, she received those diagnoses we just spoke about. And I guess the doctor was like, well, you'll be fine. Go on about your life. Now, remember that affidavit we spoke about earlier where Joshua admitted to being a liar?
I do.
Well, it's coming back into play. Because one of the other things Joshua swore to in that affidavit was that Melinda had never actually threatened to kill herself.
Shocking.
Yeah. One of the things that makes this case so frustrating and perplexing is that you never really know what to believe. There are a lot of depictions of character and accusations peppering this case from both sides, and most of them are of questionable validity, to put it mildly. What really got investigators interested in Melinda as a potential suspect wasn't Joshua's claims, though. Rather, it was something they found after their initial search, when they later searched the contents of a trash can in Melinda's apartment. More on that next. And now, back to Trenton's story. The day after Trenton's disappearance, when investigators searched through the contents of a trash can in the apartment where Melinda and Trenton lived, they found something surprising. Photos of Trenton in the trash. And not just photos, but also other items, including some of his toys and an ultrasound image from when Melinda had been pregnant with him.
That's surprising.
Yeah, investigators thought this was strange. Why would a mother throw away photos of her own child, or his toys, or his clothes, or something as sentimental as an ultrasound image?
Especially if the child is missing.
Naturally, they wondered whether Melinda throwing away these items might have been symbolic of her discarding Trenton, or at least coming to terms with the belief that she'd never see him again. However, Let's not forget that Melinda suffered from obsessive-compulsive disorder, and this condition can sometimes cause sufferers to clean and organize compulsively. In my opinion, and I'm not a doctor, it seems plausible that someone suffering from this condition might feel compelled to throw away a child's toys or even photographs of their child if they deemed them no longer needed. For example, what if Trenton had toys he had outgrown and rarely or never played with that Melinda perceived as unnecessarily taking up space in their home? What if she had removed photo prints from frames with the intention to replace them with different prints? What if she had other copies of that ultrasound image, perhaps a digital copy?
That's all very logical reasoning.
In this case, I imagine she might have discarded those items, perceiving them as no longer necessary, and perhaps her standards for what was necessary might have been heightened by her condition. In further support of this theory, I located an article by journalist Austin L. Miller for the Ocala Star-Banner, in which Melinda's grandparents say they believe Melinda or a friend of hers might have thrown the items out because they were stained with black powder during investigators' original search of the apartment, and black powder, used in the detection and collection of latent prints, would have been difficult to remove. And if that was the case, it might have been even more reason for Melinda to discard those items.
Yeah, that's extremely good reason.
This is only my personal perspective, but I think it's worth considering. As a parent, I know that getting rid of old toys my kids no longer play with can be a real relief. And if they were stained with black powder, I would take that opportunity in a heartbeat.
Yeah, it's always, especially when it's a noisy toy.
Oh yeah, something you've been tripping over for 6 months and the kids never play with it anyway. And you know, like if they see you throw away, they might get sad, but like they're not here, obviously, in this case. It's stained with black powder and you're like, this has got to go.
Totally reasonable.
Now, when it comes to the items that were discarded, we actually have photos of many of them, and we've posted them on our site if you want to check them out for yourself. When it comes to the discarded clothing, I've got to say, it's clearly clothing for an infant, not a two-year-old. Although the photo doesn't show any of the size tags, they're onesies that are clearly way too small for a toddler. One of them is even one of those blanket sleepers, you know, the ones that are basically a zip-up sack with no legs.
Yeah.
Those are something you use for newborns. You put one of those on a two-year-old, even if it fit, and it would be cruel, like putting a child in a straitjacket. So I totally get why Melinda would discard the clothing. And I feel similarly about the toys as well. For example, one of those stackable ring toys was among those that were discarded. And generally, kids aren't too enthralled with those by the time they reach 2 years of age. As a parent myself, the clothing and toys look like stuff it would be totally normal to throw out, given Trenton's age. As for the rest of it, well, it's different. For example, there's a Mother's Day card and a pink Beanie Baby Mother's Day bear. While the card indicates it was intended as a gift from Trenton, obviously he was far too young to select it or give it to her himself. And while I don't know who the adult was who'd given those items to Melinda for Mother's Day, it seems possible that it was Joshua. And honestly, given the status of their relationship, I don't think it would be strange for Melinda to throw out gifts that Joshua had given her.
It's certainly a tense enough situation for that to make sense.
Yeah, and similarly, when people talk about the discarded sonogram image, they never seem to mention that it's part of a collage in a frame along with a baby portrait and a wedding announcement clipped from the paper celebrating Melinda and Joshua's wedding.
That also makes sense.
Again, I could see her throwing this out, although perhaps she could have removed the ultrasound and baby portrait images if it wasn't all glued together. I don't know. But overall, I don't find the discarded items particularly suspicious. Take a look for yourself, though, and let us know what you think. When investigators questioned Melinda about her activities on the day of Trenton's disappearance, she told them something that was pretty strange. Something that, in my mind, sent up red flags that the discarded clothing and other items hadn't.
What is it?
Well, according to what Melinda told investigators, earlier on the day of Trenton's disappearance, Melinda and Trenton had spent several hours driving around north of Orlando near the Ocala National Forest. The reason? Melinda had just purchased a shotgun and wanted to try it out at the public outdoor shooting range located in the National Forest.
So, obviously, I'm all for involving kids with firearms at a young age to raise the awareness of firearm safety.
Not too.
But 2-year-old, that seems a little early to get them accustomed to the sounds of shotguns.
It's absurdly early. The very idea of taking a toddler to a shooting range, especially a public outdoors one, is difficult for me to wrap my head around. It probably goes without saying that a toddler should never be taken to any shooting range, but in addition to that, public outdoor shooting ranges are especially dangerous to children. The reason why? They're unsupervised, and they're free. You add random people and guns to this combination, and you're basically taking your life in your hands when you visit. I know this well because there's a public outdoor shooting range in a national forest not far from where we live, and I hate it. Not the range itself, but going there, because the amount of absurdly dangerous shenanigans I've witnessed people commit there. If I want to feel safe going there and using it to sight in a rifle or something, I've really got to find a time when the hour and weather is undesirable enough that no other people want to be there. You go in, you do what you got to do, you get out.
I wish that we could contribute it to like specific times, or that we could even say during the middle of the day when most people would be at work would be safer, but it's really a roll of the dice of who's there when you happen to show up.
You got to go there when it's really cold, I think, is the key.
Cold and windy. Nobody wants to sight in their gun when it's windy.
Anyway, as it turns out, fortunately, Melinda got lost, so she and Trenton never made it to the range. And after a couple hours of driving around, she gave up and they returned home. Now, you're probably wondering about that brand new shotgun Melinda had just purchased.
Well, I am.
Investigators eventually ended up collecting it as potential evidence and having it forensically evaluated, and they found that it had never been fired. So there's no possibility that Melinda or anyone else had used it to shoot Trenton, for the record.
That's great news.
With that being said, Melinda was the primary person of interest in regards to Trenton's disappearance as far as investigators were concerned. Police actually began following her, hoping that if she had done anything to Trenton, she'd lead them to him. Meanwhile, many miles away, TV personality Nancy Grace got wind of Trenton's disappearance and prepared to do an episode on it, ostensibly with the goal of raising public awareness. And Melinda appeared on the show via telephone to talk about her son's disappearance. And when Melinda spoke to Nancy, it quickly came to seem as if old Nancy felt she knew exactly who was responsible for Trenton's disappearance. That's right. Far away, in her TV studio, the media personality was seemingly possessed of a righteous certainty, the origins of which I won't begin to speculate on. As a result, whenever Melinda was interviewed over the phone on the show, Nancy's questioning was what many have called aggressive. Lawyers representing Melinda's estate would later describe Nancy's questioning as abuse of media power and the intentional infliction of emotional distress upon a bereaved, emotionally unstable young woman with known mental health conditions. According to an article by Stephen Hudak for the Palm Beach Post, these same lawyers also claimed that the show's producers knowingly tricked Melinda into appearing on the show against her attorney's wishes, baiting her by promising to air photos of her missing son to their vast audience. If you'd like to judge for yourself whether or not the questions posed to Melinda were aggressive, we've linked to the interview transcript on our website. Now, perhaps you've noticed that I referred to those lawyers as representing Melinda's estate rather than Melinda herself.
I did think it was an interesting phrasing.
Well, that's because within 24 hours of participating in the telephone interview with Nancy Grace, Melinda drove to the place where she felt most at home, her grandparents' house, went into a closet with a gun belonging to her grandfather and ended her own life. She did this just hours before her interview with Nancy Grace was scheduled to air.
I'm sure in all of her TV riches, Nancy Grace has admonished any responsibility of having any involvement of driving her to that point.
Oh, yeah. She says that if anything, Melinda killed herself out of guilt. That was her official statement on an interview with Good Morning America. Also, Melinda is not the only person who has taken their own life after being aggressively interviewed by Nancy Grace. In any case, Melinda left three suicide notes, one for her grandparents, one for her parents who lived in New York, and one for the public. We've posted images of each note on our website if you'd like to read them in full. The letter to her grandparents was the warmest, with her expressing appreciation for their support and explaining her decision as follows. Quote, "Please understand that I have to do this. It's a release from stress and frustration, and I'll be happier in the end," end quote. Along with the letter, Melinda also left her grandparents her savings in cash. As for the letter she wrote to the public, I'm going to read that in its entirety. Here it is. Quote, "Public, I'm sorry this is short. Usually I plan things and am better with my writing. Your focus came off my son. I love him and only wanted him safe in my arms. You created rumors and twisted words. Usually I am strong and what others say does not affect me. However, I am young, have worked my ass off, and am being faced with ridicule and criticism. I only wish you do not push anyone else. I do not bleed my emotions to the public, and throughout this situation, you did not understand that. There were many more errors you made in understanding me, but time is short, and I have more important people to speak to." End quote. So essentially, Melinda's suicide letter to the public accused them of assuming she was involved in her son's disappearance because she was a private and reserved person who didn't like to express her emotions in public view. Basically, she didn't act the way TV audiences thought she should act, and so she was perceived as guilty in the court of public opinion. After Melinda's death, the rumors about Melinda's possible guilt, of course, didn't cease, nor did media insensitivity. For example, Melinda's mother has said that while she was in the receiving line at Melinda's funeral, a reporter came up to her and told her she needed to speak to her because she was on a deadline. And like I mentioned a few moments ago, Scott, when Nancy Grace was questioned about Melinda's suicide in that Good Morning America interview, she said, quote, "If anything, I would suggest that guilt made her commit suicide. To suggest that a 15 or 20 minute interview can cause someone to commit suicide is focusing on the wrong thing," end quote.
Maybe attacking a potential victim of a crime instead of focusing on the missing son.
Yeah.
It's also taking away from the point.
That's what Melinda's parents thought, and so they sued for Melinda's wrongful death. And ultimately, the lawsuit was settled. The terms of the settlement dictated that the defendants would pay $200,000 to be set aside in a fund to be used to find Trenton, and if he was found before his 13th birthday, any leftover funds would go into a trust fund for his later use. If he wasn't found before his 13th birthday, any leftover funds would be donated to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. For the record, Trenton is or would be 18 years old at the time of this recording and remains missing. Moving on to theories surrounding Trenton's disappearance, we'll start with ones that rely upon Melinda's involvement. One theory is that Melinda might have killed Trenton via unknown means for unknown reasons and somehow disposed of his body in a thorough enough fashion that it has yet to be discovered despite extensive ground and water searches. For example, remember when she claimed she was driving around in the area of the National Forest with Trenton?
I have a feeling they'd search that area.
They did. Cell phone tower pings suggest that it was true that she was driving in the area, and some speculate that rather than seeking out a shooting range, she actually could have been disposing of Trenton's remains. And as for the remains not being found despite search parties' efforts, well, Florida is teeming with carnivorous scavengers and the August heat is intense. Human remains left outdoors in a forested setting during the summer would decompose rapidly and would likely be subject to consumption by wildlife, such as alligators. When it comes to this heart-wrenching murder theory, there's a single piece of potential evidence that really stands out to me as potentially supporting it.
And what exactly is that?
Well, it goes all the way back to the 911 call whenever Melinda spoke to the dispatcher. Remember when I said she described Trenton and what he was wearing?
I do.
It's the description of his clothing that got me. Whenever the dispatcher initially asked what he was wearing, she said she didn't know. And sure, she had just discovered her son missing and was no doubt stressed beyond belief. Maybe she just blanked for a minute. I think that would be totally normal. But when the dispatcher asks again, she says, quote, "He might have had his shoes and his shirt off. No shoes. I know who friggin' did it." End quote. The dispatcher replies, quote, "No shoes, no shirt. He's an Asian male." End quote. And Melinda says, quote, "He's wearing jean shorts. He's 2 years old." End quote. When I read this, I thought it was odd that Melinda had put Trenton to bed wearing denim shorts. Jeans definitely aren't sleepwear and generally aren't the most comfortable, so most parents would put their toddler in something softer, usually pajamas, for bedtime. And it also seems a little odd that she'd talk about whether or not he was wearing shoes, considering he'd been in bed for the night. But then again, I also get that sometimes kids get really sleepy and pass out in the clothes they're wearing, and sometimes it may seem better to let them rest peacefully than to wake them up and wrangle them into a set of pajamas.
That being said, I also have experience trying to put a toddler to bed. And even though they're no longer toddlers, they want to wear what they want to wear.
That's true. Picking out what one is going to wear to bed can be a very big deal, a power move even, in a young child's life.
It is definitely a power move. And sometimes after you have satisfied their desire to have a certain or specific outfit, they decide that they will change it just to be exercising that same power.
Yes, exactly.
So I can see having a toddler say they wanted to wear shoes to bed and also pants because I identify with the adult in that moment.
It's odd, but it's not out of the question. However, I couldn't help but think that if Melinda had harmed Trenton earlier that day, he might have been wearing daytime clothes at the time, and she might have said she didn't know what he'd worn to bed in order to buy herself a couple moments to think before describing what he'd been wearing at the time of death. Because, of course, if his remains were found, that's what he would be wearing.
I can see that.
And if she said, oh, he was wearing a cotton pajama set, and he was found in jean shorts, well, obviously she's a liar. But if he wore the jean shorts to bed, who knows?
I can see it going either way, honestly.
Of course, this is only speculation, and to date, no evidence has been found to prove that Melinda harmed Trenton. Another popular theory is that Melinda might have given Trenton away to someone, and there's a reason people think this might be the case. More than one reason, actually.
What reason is that?
Well, one of the reasons was a sighting of Melinda and Trenton reported by a witness. The witness, who was a construction worker, claimed that 10 days before Trenton had gone missing, they'd seen Melinda and Trenton meeting with an unidentified couple at a construction site.
Are there any reasons why she would be at the construction site in the first place?
Not that I know of, and as far as I know, not that investigators know of. The construction worker described the couple that she met with as Asian or Hispanic, well-dressed and driving a metallic-colored Cadillac Escalade, possibly with New York plates. Whether or not the mother and child the construction worker saw really were Melinda and Trenton is impossible to know. However, if it was them, there are a couple of details that stand out. For one, the possible New York license plate on the well-dressed couple's SUV. Melinda was actually from New York, had grown up there. But at age 17, she decided to move in with her grandparents in Florida for a total change of pace. So needless to say, she knew people in New York. Secondly, if Melinda was planning to give Trenton away to someone, ostensibly to raise as their own without arousing suspicion, an Asian couple would potentially make sense since Melinda herself was Korean and Trenton was biracial with his father being white. However, when police first received this tip from the construction worker, they didn't give it much thought since, according to an article by journalist Millard K. Ives, they believed it conflicted with Melinda's whereabouts that day, based on her phone and computer records. And if they're talking about computer records, I assume that means she was likely believed to be home during the time of this alleged sighting. However, investigators later revisited the tip, and the witness told them that he might have been off by a few hours when it came to his time estimate. Which makes sense because he was reporting this well after the sighting, which occurred 10 days before Trenton even disappeared. And if the time frame was a little different, that makes this alleged sighting more plausible. Fast forward to the day of Trenton's disappearance, and we have more alleged witnesses. On the afternoon of August 27th, at about 11:15 a.m., Melinda reportedly went through the drive-thru at a Wendy's restaurant. The employee working the drive-thru reported this, and that she had Trenton with her. According to that same employee, Melinda returned 20 minutes later, alone, and apparently they spoke about this, at least briefly, because Melinda reportedly told the Wendy's employee that she'd left Trenton with either his grandparents or a babysitter. Then, several hours later, at approximately 4 p.m., another witness said that they were at that same Wendy's going to the restroom whenever they almost ran into a woman who resembled Melinda. Just like the previous time, she was alone. Now, why Melinda would repeatedly return to the same Wendy's restaurant if she really was up to something shady, I have no idea. But investigators say that Melinda's grandparents lived too far away from the restaurant for Melinda to leave, drop Trenton off with them, and return within a 20-minute window. She was meeting them at their house, that is. According to an article by journalist Christine Dellert, investigators came to believe that if Melinda had handed off Trenton to someone, this had occurred somewhere close to the restaurant. Cell phone records indicate that twice that day, after Wendy's visits, Melinda drove to the nearby Paddock Mall in Ocala. What she did there is unknown. Investigators also found that Melinda had a friend, Chai Wen, who worked as a manager at the rent-a-center store across the street from the Wendy's where Melinda was repeatedly sighted. They also discovered that she had called him on the day of Trenton's disappearance. Whether that has anything whatsoever to do with Trenton's disappearance is unknown, but police did question him and he even took a polygraph. As far as I know, it didn't arouse any suspicion.
Okay.
When it comes to theories about Melinda giving Trenton away, some point to the fact that she became a notary public on August 1st, less than a month before Trenton's disappearance. Possibly, some speculate, she could have intended to use her notary seal to falsify documents that would make it easier for her son to disappear and live with others. However, it's also worth noting that Melinda lost one of her two jobs around this time and may very well have become a notary public simply to give herself a bit of an edge in the administrative job market.
Yeah, as far as the whole notary public thing goes, it makes sense to give yourself an advantage in the administrative world, but as far as I know, those are pretty meticulous records. So if she was falsifying or doing something shady with it, it should be pretty easy to uncover.
You'd think at least it would leave a pretty obvious paper trail because it would have her name on it.
And her specific seal number and certification number or whatever.
Right. But on that note, there's a twist to the theory of Melinda giving Trenton up. Some theorize that she might have sent him to live with another family in her native land of South Korea. However, it's important to consider that Melinda was adopted from South Korea by her American parents when she was only 4 months old. To the best of my knowledge, Melinda had no other ties to Korea and didn't speak Korean, so this is perhaps an unlikely theory. Nonetheless, investigators searched flight records for any sign of Trenton being sent overseas without any luck. As for why Melinda might have wanted to arrange an unlawful adoption for her son, it's difficult to say. However, her experience as a mother had been marred by conflict, harassment, and serious false accusations. And all of this occurred while she was working two jobs and going to school. Trying to build a better life for herself and her son must have felt exhausting. Despite the fact that she had full custody of Trenton at the time of his disappearance, maybe she thought there might be further, bitter custody battles in the future. Maybe she thought she'd be falsely accused again and possibly end up needlessly taken into custody, whether in a psychiatric facility or in jail. Perhaps she thought the only way to guarantee her son a life free of these troubles was to give him away to another family and make Joshua and his mother believe he was gone. It's just a theory, one of many. In any case, it's easy to see why theories that revolve around Trenton being given away to another family are so appealing to both the public and some investigative professionals. The best case scenario in Trenton's disappearance is that he's out there living a happy and healthy life somewhere, unaware that he's a missing person. After all, the other possibilities are much darker. Now that we've discussed theories that rely upon Melinda's involvement in her son's disappearance, we're going to move on to the other side of the coin, Trenton's father and paternal grandmother. After all, many sources posit that Melinda might have caused her son to disappear in order to keep him from his father. However, when Trenton disappeared, she had full custody of her son. It was Joshua, Trenton's father, who'd been on the losing end of a bitter custody battle. Well, Joshua and his mother, who he swore in an affidavit, pressured him to falsely accuse Melinda in order to keep Trenton out of her custody. So, is it possible that Joshua and/or his mother, who again he swore pressured him into making false accusations against Melinda in an attempt to gain custody, could have been involved in Trenton's disappearance? Many people, such as TV personality Nancy Grace, have had little or no trouble assuming that Melinda might be willing to commit criminal acts to keep her son from his other parent. So it's no surprise that some people think the same of Joshua, who by his own admission had taken serious, illegal measures in the past in an effort to do just that. Let's start with Joshua's alibi during the time frame when Trenton was abducted. Joshua claims he was hanging out with friends. Whether there's security footage of any kind, location data, or third-party witness accounts to corroborate this claim, I don't know. The official investigation and media coverage regarding Trenton's disappearance have mostly been pretty myopic, focusing intently on Melinda. I wish I knew whether Joshua's alibi was ever thoroughly proven, but unfortunately, I don't. Additionally, I don't know whether his mother, Carla, or any close associates of hers had an alibi or not. And considering that Joshua claimed he falsely filed his accusations against Melinda because Carla pressured him to, I find it difficult to separate Joshua and Carla in the context of this non-custodial family abduction theory.
Yeah, it's really difficult. Just everything. They seem pretty attached at the hip at this point.
Yes, weirdly so. One of the first things that occurred to me in support of this theory is that if Trenton was abducted by someone he knew, such as his non-custodial parent or grandparent, that could explain why Melinda and her guests didn't hear him crying out over the noise of their movie. Most two-year-olds would cry if a stranger attempted to take them from their bed. A family member might be a different story, though. A family member might very well have been able to lift Trenton through the window without him making a fuss. As for what might have happened to Trenton afterward if he was abducted by a non-custodial family member, I don't know. But according to a study from the U.S. Department of Justice published just 4 years prior to Trenton's disappearance, 53% of children abducted by a parent were abducted by their father, while slightly under half as many, 25%, were abducted by their mother. So there's some precedent to suggest that fathers are perhaps more likely to abduct their children than mothers. In any case, we've already discussed the role Joshua's mother played in his life. Something we haven't discussed is his father's role, but I'd be remiss not to mention him at all, because he himself is tied to local law enforcement and crime in the area where this whole case has unfolded.
The way you said that makes me think he either has a very impressive criminal record or he's a cop.
What if I told you it was both?
I wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah, to be exact, James Duckett was a police officer working for the city of Mascot, Florida. That's a town in Lake County, the same county where this episode takes place. However, James is no longer a police officer. Rather, he's sitting on death row.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, and it's because he was convicted of sexually assaulting and murdering an 11-year-old girl in 1987.
Well, then, that definitely took a darker turn than I was anticipating.
Very dark. Now, certainly, having a parent who's murdered a child does not mean that someone will repeat that behavior. You may have heard statistics, however, that claim the children of incarcerated parents are more likely to later become incarcerated themselves, and that's true. The children of incarcerated parents are themselves victims, often overlooked, of crime. And according to a study from the Psychological Bulletin Journal, cited in an article on the children of incarcerated parents by the National Institute of Justice Journal, quote, the most common consequence of parental incarceration appears to fall under the umbrella of antisocial behavior, which describes any number of behaviors that go against social norms, including criminal acts and persistent dishonesty, end quote. In Joshua's personal case, we know that he was persistently dishonest in his dealings with Melinda, the courts, and law enforcement. Whether or not that had anything to do with him being the child of an incarcerated murderer is impossible to know. But I bring this up because often when the Ducketts and the media spoke about Melinda, it almost seemed as if they defined her chiefly by her struggles with her mental health, and her name was really dragged through the mud. For example, even though Joshua had submitted an affidavit to court stating that he'd falsely accused her of threatening to harm their child, many media outlets conveniently glossed over that in their coverage, reporting only that she'd been accused of threatening Trenton. The fact that that accusation had turned out to be false was often left out of the picture.
What news reporters do we know that enjoy admitting they were wrong?
None that I can think of.
None mentioned in this case.
No, certainly not. In contrast, the media typically let the skeletons in Joshua's family closet rest, which is kind of surprising. Can you imagine the kind of sensationalistic headlines you could make with this kind of thing? However, the truth is that Joshua's life story hadn't been one woven exclusively from sunshine and rainbows either. He suffered the deeply adverse experience of having a parent incarcerated for one of the worst crimes imaginable. That affected his emotional development, mental health, behavior, or relationships with others. Well, that would be totally normal. And sure, Joshua did not ask to grow up as the child of an incarcerated killer. But you know what? Melinda didn't ask to suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorder or depression either. All any of us can do in life is make the best of the hand we're dealt, and no one in this story is an exception. To use someone's personal vulnerabilities rather than their actions as an excuse to vilify them is not only unfair, but potentially crippling to the justice process.
And to that individual as well.
Right, not that anybody cared about that, obviously. And on that same note, growing up with an incarcerated parent is a type of trauma, but it's a trauma that many American children endure without becoming abductors, killers, or criminals at all. So please don't interpret the statistic I quoted from the Psychological Bulletin Journal as a claim that all children of incarcerated parents are liars or criminals, as that's definitely not the case. If you know anything about the disappearance of Trenton Duckett, please contact the Leesburg Police Department at 352-787-2121. And if you struggle with thoughts of self-harm or suicide, please know that you don't have to struggle alone. There are people ready to listen 24/7 in English or Spanish. Call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline anytime at 1-800-273-8255.
That's all for this episode of Last Seen Alive. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Make sure you check out our website, lastseenalivepodcast.com, for photos from the story and links to the sources we used to write it. While you're at it, follow us on Insta and Twitter at LSA Podcast. New episodes of Last Seen Alive go live every other Monday. See you then. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed what you heard here today, please take a moment to rate or review Last Seen Alive and tell your friends to check us out too. We really would appreciate it. Last Seen Alive is written and researched by you, Leah. Audio engineering and editing is provided by me, Scott.